Welcome to the Sage of Three Paths podcast. We are three brothers who use this space to talk about a range of topics, anything from politics, race, anime, and pop culture, each giving our own perspectives and opinions. I'm the youngest, Mo Janna, also known as Junior Lab.
I'm the oldest, Okello, but my brothers call me AJ.
Middle child, Oz, aka Wizard King.
We three brothers.
One sec. We once again thank you for tuning in and joining us on this sometimes cathartic journey. Let's dive right in.
I would say in African culture in particular, now mental health is almost, perhaps it's changing a little bit now, but it's almost taboo, where if someone was to have a serious mental illness, say this is in Africa, Sierra Leone, we'll keep narrowing it down, Freetown, and there's a the local crazy guy who drinks, who does drugs and acts all kind of ways up and down the high street. They would just say, oh, this guy's crazy. But really, if you sat him down or had someone to do an assessment, you'd think, okay, this guy is on some sort of spectrum or he needs aid from some direction, because just leaving him out there to do his own thing is dangerous as hell.
Or has some deep trauma.
Yeah. 100%. And it needs to be discussed.
You know, it's one thing I say, everyone has their own demons. It's one of the things I'm trying to teach to the young boys we have. So like Ozzy's boy and my boy. Everyone has their demons. And both our boys have had to go through their fair share of hardship at such a young age. I mean, my oldest is 9. And he's already had to go through hardship through no fault of his own whatsoever. Just merely being born to parents who didn't get along.
Yeah.
So I say to him...
And that's chaff.
Yeah. And yeah. I say to him, look at your life. You've already gone through yours. More will come, because that life is arbitrary in its nature of discord and is full with its ups and downs. But just really important, don't be the person who makes someone else feel worse.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what they're going through.
And that's it, isn't it? And, you know, I was saying yesterday, actually, I was doing a lecture on trauma yesterday, and we were talking about resilience. And this word resilience, you know, we hear it all the time, don't we? Oh, kids, they'll be all right. They're so resilient. Oh, look at that street homeless person. Who loads? He's really resilient. He'd be all right. And it's overused to the point of almost being dismissive sometimes. Well, you've coped with loads of shit, so you're going to be really resilient. You'll be grand. You'll get on with it much better than somebody else. And, you know, think about what you were saying about that guy. Yeah, the deep trauma that people hold. What? It's not a life sentence trauma. If we didn't have trauma, we'd be robots, because trauma's subjective. It happens to all of us. And something that I perceive to be traumatic, you may not.
Yeah, we all experience different kinds of pain.
Yeah, so saying... don't be the person that makes somebody feel worse is really important to young people. And I think, you know, I've got stepchildren and, you know, they've lived a lot of their lives on social media, and you see keyboard warriors and these thoughtless, heartless comments that everyone thinks it's all right to make. You wouldn't dare say it to someone in a pub, because they knock you out. But they say the worst stuff in the world online, and it's so flippant that it's translating into real life. And they, you know, it does make me sad, because people don't really seem to care. And it's much easier to go, oh, look at him, that's the pisshead, or look at her, she's mental, or all these other derogatory kind of terms that we levy at people to just kind of, it's a form of unconscious bias. It's social comparison bias. That's our inherent need to see ourselves as better than others. You know, and that's what that's about. Why don't we just take the time to see what's going on for that person? You know, we can't fix them. We can't change them, but we can help them. And then when they're ready, they may accept the help.
You know, so
it's a really important message, especially for boys, because boys are, you know, no matter what, you know, let's talk about our mental health and It's okay not to be okay and all of that. And yet I hear it all day, every day. Man up, don't be a pussy. Boys, don't cry. What are you thinking of? And in County Lines, for example, I do a lot of work in County Lines with the police. And this culture of women and boys and girls as commodities and collateral and this very depersonalised kind of way we've got of looking at things that really curtail people's ability, you know, to feel emotion and to kind of be empathic, I think.
We had a good friend of mine, who a fellow writer, she's a feminist writer, social activism as well, and she was saying that our approach to knowledge is quite binary, quite patriarchal.
I listened to this last week. This was last week, wasn't it? I listened to it the other night.
Yeah. Shouts out Fiona.
So we do have the
second
part.
I see what I was letting myself in for.
But yeah, so the second half of that conversation is out soon. But it just gets deeper because that idea of this patriarchal mindset that we all have of, okay, so we need to use words to excuse the behavior because we've got better things to do, or we're better based off the, I forget the term that you use, the societal pressures.
Oh, social comparison bias.
Social comparison bias, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I've got, because the example we gave of this guy in Freetown, Sierra Leone, was quite vague, but I've got a specific example. There was this guy in Barcelona when I was in Spain, and I would often see him. I moved around a fair bit, but when I was living in the centre of the city, in basically like the inner city, quite rough, there was this one homeless guy who was always on a bike, but he had no shoes, no socks, and the bike tires had no treads on them. It was just the metal rims that he was going with. And he would go up and down, and I would see him, like, I would say 10 kilometers by the beach or something, or in just like near the flats area. And this one time I saw him outside of McDonald's, well, sleeping next to a bank, because that's what quite a few homeless people do in Barcelona. They go to the various banks and sleep inside where it's as warm as possible.
Yeah.
But this one time I saw him sleeping outside because there's no space inside. And I had just finished a night shift. I'm heading home. I'm just like, oh, man, let me buy you something to eat. So we went to the McDonald's, which is literally next door. I bought him something and he didn't say a single word, not even a thank you. Now, for me, that's not the issue. I was happy to just do this thing for him. But as he was going away, I was like, damn, like, I kind of want to have a conversation with him to figure out his story.
How did you end
exactly,
up here?
Exactly. Yeah. His story.
How,
like,
did you get here?
How on earth did it get to the point where a random guy from London is here buying you some sustenance, and God knows if you've eaten. Where's your shoes?
Yeah.
Why does the bike not have any treads on? And why is no one else freaking out about this? Why am I the only one thinking, like, this is broken? This whole situation is broken. Mm. Yeah, shocking. Shocking, really.
Yeah. But what's interesting there is the amount of times you said why.
Mm. Yeah. Hey, your favourite word. There you go.
Kindred spirits.
Because it's that, isn't it? It's, and I don't know, and I've always had this thing about levels of thinking, and, you know, it was very banal and basic when I was a teenager, but I always used to, with people that I interact with, try to decide what level they thought at, because we've got people that think up to about level 3, which is about where I am in the world, where the people closest to me are, what's going on in my backyard, for example, and don't really think too much about anything else. Then the 5s or the 6s, who may be aware that things aren't the same absolutely everywhere, but because it's not affecting them, they're not too bothered about it, and they'll talk about it if pushed. And then people that think further than that, that ask the why, and I was one of the people that always asked the why. because it is that we get the end result, the behaviour, the presentation, whatever it is. And that's always the interest for me is why? How did you end up here? What happened? What was it that took you off down this path? You know, and just listening to you talk there, it's that why, isn't it? Mm. And I don't think enough people ask why. They just go, well, it is what it is. And, I'll donate to the RSPCA and save the children once a month, and I don't really care where that donation goes, but I've done my bit.
Mm.
And there's no why. It's almost like we assuage ourselves, don't we, by throwing money in a chugger's tin on the high street on a Saturday and, all right, that's my bit. I don't need to think.
You don't have to think about it. Do you know the clapping for the NHS?
Oh,
I'm not sure what your views are, but when you take a step back and you look at the whole picture and it's like, okay, we're clapping for them. A lot of them are in incredible situations because of COVID, and they're really, really putting in the work for the country, the society, all over the country. And now you hear that they're not going to get an increase, or the increase is incredibly... It's a joke.
It's like the increase in wage.
Increase in wage, yes. Mm-hmm. But also, further along, I heard today, it was on the radio, they were saying how quite a lot of medical staff have long-term COVID issues.
Yep.
And because they've got these long-term COVID issues, they can't work, and they're getting to the end of their sick pay. So they're going to be left in situations where they won't be getting money whatsoever. Or
change their whole career path based off something completely out of their control, from being a doctor or an assistant, whatever, to doing digital marketing or coding or something like that.
Yep.
That's not to knock them, but that's quite a segue from something that's completely out of your control.
And
of course,
the people in power who could make a change for them said, we should clap for them.
I mean...
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's so my friend is quite heavily involved. I'm hoping to become involved at some stage, but she's very heavily involved in setting up trauma hubs for the NHS staff that have worked in ICU throughout the whole of the pandemic because of the PTSD, that people are, you know, suffering from. I'm hoping to do some work with her around that. But this whole... Well, first of all, I just want to say clap for the NHS made me really angry because we had all sorts of people that were keeping the country going. The bin men, the cleaners, the domestics, the porters, the support workers, the frontline workers, the hotel staff who were, you know, one minute checking Mr. Businessman in and out, and the next minute had their hotels full of people drinking a hand wash and nicking the cleaner's shoes and very complex behaviours all over the place. Mm. And I felt really angry on their behalf because I think they were the unsung heroes, first of all. The elements of it that I liked were the sense of... Because I got stuck in the UK for the first lockdown. I couldn't come home for 6 months, which was... awful, really. And I've also got an autoimmune disorder and fibromyalgia and asthma, so I'm registered disabled, and of course it was like, oh, you're gonna die if you go outside the door. So that was really hard because I was clinically vulnerable, so I was shielding. That went well. I got COVID in January anyway. But I remember the sense of community where everybody was out, you know, doing their bit, and everybody was getting really emotional, and I just thought, how do the NHS staff feel?
Mm.
How do they feel about this? Because nothing's changed for them. They're absolutely... I mean, it was like a war. It was like the equivalent of the trenches in the First World War for some people. They've got no increase in pay. As you say, they're coming to the end of their sick pay. And it was just another token gesture as far as I was concerned when we... you know, spent a year clapping for them and going on about, you know, the backbone of the country, how much we all appreciate them, except for we won't give them a pay rise and we won't, you know, do this, that and the other. And I know somebody very senior in the NHS who still hasn't told her employers that she's got bipolar disorder because she feels she'd be discriminated against.
Oh, wow.
That's the NHS.
Whoa.
So
that's terrible.
You know, the NHS, unfortunately, has got managers managing managers who manage managers, and the frontline staff, you know, are paid in shirt buttons, essentially.
Yeah, that sounds like every other big business. Managers, managing managers, managed by managers.
Did you practice that beforehand? Yeah. Or was that just after?
No. I'm Irish. I can babble incessantly for hours. I'm Irish.
Do you know what, Fiona, an important thing. Sorry. An important thing you said, or I think AJ and Fiona, both of you have made points on this. It's almost as if, you know, there's parts of the system. And I think this is, yeah, specifically Fiona, I remember you said, you know, there was a moment where you got to the center of everything and you realized that this is actually wrong. The system, or systematically, there are issues that are foundationally wrong. What do you think those, what would you change if you had the power to?
But before that, what were they? What would you say was a blatantly obvious, in your face, no, this doesn't work? Or was there, or was everything hidden? The realization for you that the system's broken.
Okay, that's a really deep question that could take about 5 days to answer. And with me, probably 10, actually, but we'll try and keep it brief. So the first thing, things being sold off, things being managed by people who don't understand frontline risk, the work involved in people on the front line, the jobs, people that are business managers or people that have done degrees in, you know, kind of finance or whatever, that don't have a clue about the human part of the cog in the wheel. So that's the first thing. People with no real lived experience of whatever area they're working in, being brought in as bean counters, essentially. I was a safeguarding commissioner briefly, very briefly, in London, in Westminster and in Camden. And I didn't even last in the role a year because I'm frontline, and the people that I was working with that were commissioning services or trying to shave costs off contracts or trying to get bang for buck or whatever, the bean counters, essentially, who'd sat behind a desk all their lives, wouldn't know risk if it punched them in the face. You know, just making decisions that could potentially affect the outcome for the clients, the very clients they were supposed to be serving. You know, so that's a really big thing for me. The second thing is the way that, you know, the integral services, mental health services, NHS, the police, the probation services, the prison services, everybody worked in silos. Even though we like to cheer about joined up working and, you know, teams around people to give them the best. That was a load of old tosh. We worked in silos. So everyone was really precious about the work that they were doing with people. You'd need a bag full of gold rings and to trek through Dante's seven levels of hell to get any joint working done, because it just never happened. And so people not talking to each other, people not, you know, putting integrated services around people. And then the third thing was just completely losing sight of the people they were supposed to be helping. You know, the whole lack of person-centred working, the systems, the processes, the, you know, we go and assess somebody. Oh, will you take all these drugs and you've got this mental health and you've been convicted of this and, you know, you've done that and your kids have been removed. How can we help? Let me just remind you of every poor choice, shit life situation or you know, circumstances happened to you or that you've made a poor choice in. And then in my elevated position of power here as the worker, I'm just going to offer you a little bit of help here once I've compounded all that stuff for you. So, I mean, they're the three things. And the other thing is this fanfaring that we do in the United Kingdom. Oh, well, we're going to do this and we're going to, you know, put money into that. I mean, the domestic abuse bill, for example. The recommendations that they've had from us at Women's Aid, for example, the recommendations they've had from survivors, both male, female, LGBTQ, non-binary, the whole client groups, the government had just gone, oh, yes, well, that's lovely, but we're doing this.
Wow.
That's lovely, but we're doing this. And I'll give you an example. We want to make refugees gender inclusive now. So we're giving funding. When I say we, I don't mean Women's Aid, I mean the government. We're giving funding to organisations that say they're going to put male staff as well as female staff into a specialist women's refuge in order to be gender inclusive.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's
that's not the right way to do it, is it?
So in order to, you know, tick our equality and diversity boxes, we're not being equal or diverse to the people in the specialist service that may have experienced severe trauma, if the specialist women's service, usually at the hands of men. And then in order to tick our box at central government level to go, yeah, we're really equal and diverse in this country, we're not looking at the impact that's going to have on the women because we want to tick a box. And this is happening. Women's Aid nationally have lost a couple of contracts to organisations that say in order to be gender inclusive, we're going to make the refugees with male workers as well as female workers.
So I'm going to ask the stupid question. What's the
There's no stupid questions.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. What's the problem with having male staff in these places?
What do you think?
No. I'm playing devil's advocate here. I'm playing devil's advocate.
I'll throw an answer.
The devil just met another devil.
I'll throw an answer into that. Well, these women have suffered trauma. The statistics are saying it's predominantly men. Now, if you bring men into that situation, that could quite easily trigger someone or make someone feel uncomfortable, especially in a place where it's almost sanctuary, where they need to feel comfortable enough to open up and share and then start that road to recovery or sorting themselves out so they can progress stronger.
So while continuing to play devil's advocate, there's a two-part rebuttal there.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is the men will be trained professionals who would know how to promote a healthy environment for these women to feel comfortable and come out and say what they want to say. And secondly, you're not going to protect these women from all men all the time. There's men everywhere around them. So if you can get them accustomed to having decent men around them, then what's the problem with that?
Mm. Perhaps. Now, obviously, Fiona, come in whenever you want. But I feel
like, and again, I'm just playing devil's advocate.
He's drowning.
You do it so well.
Well, would you have preferred if I just bullshitted a bit and made it something fluffy?
No, yeah. I welcome the challenge. So here's the thing, and I totally hear with what you're saying. So, for example, when we work with perpetrators, we usually have a two-person in. So there's psychological treatment programs. When we have facilitators in those groups, we usually have a man and a woman. So the first thing is, the reason the woman's there is so that a man is not put into a position of inadvertently and unconsciously colluding with the offenders against women. Then the man is there to make sure that the woman isn't unfairly treated or discriminated or kind of being put in a position by the male offenders, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. So strictly, you know, and in home office accreditation, which we all have to do in order to facilitate those programs, them was the rules, lad. However, when the community rehabilitation centres came in and we sold all of that lot off, so low-level offenders were managed by the privately owned CRCs and the more serious offenders managed by the National Probation Service, staff shortages, staff cuts. So that didn't happen. So the message was diluted. But going back to what you're talking about within the refuge. So I hear you. I hear what you're saying. Men are trained professionals. It's almost like in the treatment of trauma, exposure, for want of a better word, mm. exposure to the threat to neutralise the idea that you know, men are all perpetrators, for example. However, what we forget in our earnest kind of need to do this is the fact that we're working with, let's say, and I'm not being biased here, I'm just saying women, for example, because that's what we're talking about. Women that may have come from a very dysfunctional childhood, women that have suffered abuse already, women that may be in relationship two or three that is abusive. And with all due respect, they don't have the training that we have. They don't understand the kind of levels of the psyche that we do as professionals when we're trained properly. Then we've got the other thing, because yes, on the surface, and if you're a reasonably intelligent woman with capacity, clearly you know that not all men are perpetrators. However, we have something called affinity bias, or like us bias and contrast bias, and that's an unconscious thing. So although I might be in a refuge and I might be very highly intelligent, I might even be in the same profession as you, I've just fled domestic abuse. Even though I know rationally that you are no threat and that you're a trained professional, you might move in a certain way, sound a certain way, do something, have a physical appearance of someone that looks just like my abuser. And that's something we can't control. So my intrinsic reaction to you will always be unsafe. I'll always feel fear. And there's nothing you can do about that. Not a great deal I can do about it either.
Welcome to the Sage of Three Paths podcast. We are three brothers who use this space to talk about a range of topics. Anything from politics, race, anime, and pop culture. Each giving our own perspectives and opinions. I'm the youngest, Mo Jana, also known as Junior Lam.
I'm the oldest, Okello, but my brothers call me AJ.
Middle child, Oz, aka Wizard King.
Affinity bias, is that what you call
it? So affinity bias is where we relate to some people better than others. So for example, I might have an affinity bias with you, Mo, because you look like my brother or you sound like my brother. So I might give you more preferable treatment than I would to Oz, who doesn't look or sound like my brother. The contrast effect is that in reverse. So where the affinity, whether reminding us of somebody or sounding or looking or representing, has a negative impact on us. Does that make sense?
Almost as if wearing a do-rag and not wanting to wear it because the experience you had when you wore it was a negative one. So because of that, you then want to behave, or you don't feel comfortable if you're in a room or if you're in a call, a Zoom call with someone who maybe you has affinity to that.
Very similar.
Person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for example, and again, you know, if I was mugged by a black man wearing a do-rag, or I was in a relationship with a black man who always wore a do-rag, who was very, very abusive to me, I went into a refuge and my key worker was a black man with a do-rag, nicest bloke in the world, professionally trained, all the rest of it. I couldn't overcome that in my state of trauma. Mm. When I was stronger, when I'd had time to recover and have some therapy and do my own discrepancy developing and find my place in the world again, I might be more able to cope with that. But that point in time, because the thing is, you see, with domestic abuse, and the reason it's changed from domestic violence to domestic abuse is because it's everything. It's physical, it's sexual, it's emotional, it's coercive control. The biggest part of domestic abuse is coercive control. Yeah. Gaslighting, making you think someone's mad. Economic abuse, you know, withholding people's right to a normal life. And when I've been broken down to the point, and again, the way this country treats our survivors, male and female, you know, the perpetrator gets a domestic abuse notice put on them while the case is coming to court. It's the survivor that's got to leave their home, take their children with them, go into refuge, leave their area, you know, leave everything in the house if they can't manage to move it all, assumes all responsibility for the children, is held to account for the children's trauma as well. And then you chuck in somebody who looks like my abuser on top of that in a place where I want to feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
Gonna be impossible.
Game over. Oh, you just killed the devil. You just shut. You traveled Dante's seven hells. You traveled through Dante's seven hells. Found a devil. Took you out your rifle. Bravo.
But can you see what I'm saying, though?
100%. I completely
unhinged. We can't, you know, our visceral reaction sometimes to things is beyond our control. And if we are in a place where we're broken, you know, we want to help people to recover. We don't want to, in the interest of equality and diversity, to tick a box, put someone in that position, because that's discriminating against them, it's disrespecting them.
And I think it goes...
That's not to say, you know, it's not to say that if you did have a refuge, for example, with male and female staff, you could give a woman an option to go there, mm-hmm. by all means.
Mm-hmm. But bear with me, so it relates back to something that you said before, where it's that window of tolerance. Perhaps when someone is admitted to a refuge or one of these centres that's there, a safe space for them to help, that window of tolerance is tiny. So the smallest thing could just send them off the handle to who knows where.
Well, most of the time, if someone's got to a place where they're going into a refuge, they're in what we call hypoarousal, which is where they're so overwhelmed, so disconnected, so broken down, so distraught, they don't even trust their own judgment. You know, we've got hyperarousal, which is where we're anxious, we have the racing thoughts, you know, our minds are going nine times the we're like that, and we meet ourselves coming back. But when things become too much, we go into disconnect. It's called hypoarousal, where we just flop out. We just can't deal with anymore, and that's when we need to hold people and make them safe. And that's in all the work that we do, not just in domestic abuse, but in all the work that we do.
Well, it goes back to what you were saying, where it's the people who, they're not on the front lines, who are making the decisions.
Yeah.
It's a perfect example of that.
No lived experience whatsoever. I was talking to somebody a little while ago, and I had a meeting with her. They've got 800 staff in their organisation. She said, okay, so 400 of them are women. How many of them do you think will have experienced or are experiencing domestic abuse? This is staff, mind. And you know, again, for the argument's sake, she asked the gender-based question. And I said, well, my stats tell me pre-COVID, 1 in 4. During COVID, that comes down to 1 in 2.8 staff.
Wow.
And she nearly fell off her chair.
Oh, my God.
She couldn't believe it. That's what my stats tell me. And I don't mean to be dismissive about survivors' experiences by referring to them as stats. That's not what I'm doing here, because, you know, that'd be the last thing I want to come across as sounding like. But that's what this is, things that are reported, or people are cautioned for, or people are arrested for, or people are convicted for. Jess Phillips stood in the Houses of Parliament on the 11th of March. She's the Shadow Domestic Abuse Minister. And it took her five and a half minutes.
Shout out to Jess Phillips.
She's epic.
From Birmingham.
Epic. She stood there and recited the names of 118 women and their children that were killed just in a year in lockdown, because it went off the charts.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, just blows my mind that people that don't work with people and don't do any formal training or have any understanding about, you know, the delicacy of human beings get to make such monumental decisions about the services that are provided for them. It blows my mind and it frustrates me on a daily basis, I'm honest.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So the work that you're doing, and I'm assuming that others around the country, around the world, are trying to do more and more, 10 years from now, do you feel that things would have changed? They would have trended more positively? So more people have access to help?
Well, there's two parts to that answer. The first part, you know, like everything else in the UK, trauma-informed care or trauma-informed working has become a buzzword. So everybody wants to commission a service that's trauma-informed and psychologically informed. So trauma-informed is about the person and the policy and the procedure around the work that you do. Psychologically informed environment is about an open, safe, welcoming space. Fantastic. The reality is that costs money. So what I see a lot of is people contacting my organisation going, oh, well, can you train this group of staff, that group? And I'm like, okay, but what about your directors?
Mm.
What about your policy makers? What about, oh, well, you know, well, they don't work with people on the front line, so, you know. Well, no, because it has to be organisational. You know, you can't teach a group of people how to be trauma-informed and then they've got to go away and use a piece of massively uninformed paperwork. It doesn't work like that.
I've got a really terrible analogy to see if it goes along with what you're saying. So It's like training the dogs to do tricks, but not training the dog walkers how to get the dogs to do the tricks.
Exactly. I love it. That's not terrible.
hey.
Yeah.
Was that okay? I love it.
Yeah, I actually have a friend, and him and his father run a business. And it is a charity. I think it started off as a charitable business. And I'll get the name and hopefully add this to the to the description. So it's all right. And add this to the description so we can, I guess people can reach out. But yeah, what they aim to do is going for management in businesses and basically teaching them racial bias training. And understanding and I guess going through and hearing some of the workshops that they do and how they present it to the businesses, I think it goes exactly with what you're saying. It's an issue that has to be addressed at the top. And, you know, it can't just be from the ground up, because being honest, there is a disconnect, you know, from massive. The actual frontliners and the people that are actually doing the work. Even in my line of work, you know, I work with business owners, project managers, and a lot of the time is, why is this, or how can we get A to B? And it's all around the people. How can we talk about it? Why are we not communicating? Where can we expose and have that open space where we can communicate and it is in a form where it can be digestible by everyone, not just, oh, well, I can read it and that's fine, or I can type this up and I can complete this, that's fine. It's a creating that safe space. And I completely agree with the fact that, you know, maybe in 10 years we need to, or maybe now actually, not even maybe, we should. We should, and it should have been happening. But it has to be on all levels, not just, okay, my staff are going to get this training. You need to be a part of that as well. So absolutely. If you're a business owner and you're listening, make sure you're going on some of these trainings and fund it. I think if the money's needed, put the money there.
And if you are a business owner, please sponsor our podcast, because we're trying to keep a roof shameless over our heads, food in our bellies.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I think in 10 years' time, my hope would be, especially in our sector, especially in health and social care, that people are more trauma-informed, that people understand that, you know, this isn't bad behaviour or horrible people or disrespectful clients or whatever. These are people that perhaps haven't got the same coping mechanisms as us, or have taken different paths, and they deserve to be, it's strength-based practice, isn't it? They deserve to be met where they're at and look at the stuff that's got them to where they're at and then be supported to think about whether they want to change anything. You know, and you know, we talk about money. For me, this isn't rocket science. You know, we spend hundreds of thousands of pounds on training people in fire safety, health and safety. This is psychological health and safety. And it's the only way to work with people.
Yeah.
You know, because people are, but you can have the best computer in the world, the best motherboard, the best chip, whatever it is. You chuck a human being in, usually me, but bang. You know, because no one is the same. But, you know, there are things we can do to give people more autonomy. You know, too much over years and years, people have had their natural autonomy kind of squashed out of them. And, you know, if you're in mental health services or you've been to prison or wherever, your autonomy is removed.
Yeah. Think this way, behave this way, do it this way,
or else.
And
exactly. That's always the caveat. It's or else.
Yeah. Or we'll come down on you. And you know, Eric Byrne, who is the founder of transactional analysis, you know, he talks about our functional ego states, and at the top we've got parent, then in the middle we've got adult, and then at the bottom we've got child. And on the parent, you've got nurturing and critical. So the nurturing is where we overdo and helicopter people and overcompensate, and, you know, we keep people stuck if we work with them in that way. But the punitive stuff, you do it this way, think this way, say it this way, or else. That's very critical parent. And more often than not, we'll all go into the rebel child, not listening, blah, 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 blah. You know, and why people can't see this is absolutely beyond me. But then,
because you do spend too much time thinking, in the career you have, it's, there are certain things which are obvious to you. And there's a saying which, it was told to me many years ago, but I'm only really starting to understand it as an adult. It's the answer's only obvious once you know it. Now, for a personal experience for me, was in that training I had with you, there was somewhat of a revelation on, and I've, since that training, there's certain things we spoke about which I'm adopted into my own life. One in particular is understanding why I am requesting something of someone, and that can be from like my baby, it could be my brothers, it could be anyone. It's like, am I asking this for myself to make things easier or better for me, or am I asking it for them? And now that I know, it's like, yeah, that's so obvious. But you know, it's one thing I was saying on that podcast you listened to. There are certain things which we're just not taught. And there's this concept of common sense. But I'm not too sure what should be considered as common sense, because there's a lot of things people just don't know.
Well, I hear you. But I think, you know, common decency and kindness, people should really know.
Mm. They should. I agree, they should. But
that's why I use the word should, because more often than not.
But I think we all know it's usually not the case. You usually have to be careful when you're dealing with new people, because there is a chance that there is someone there who's very willing and ready and in a position in their own lives where they'll use you for everything you got and leave you hanging on the sidewalk.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And you know, my husband doesn't trust anybody. He's very, you know, I don't trust you until you prove that I can trust you. And he's very closed and you know, and he says to me, like, how can you still believe that people are good having done what you've done for such a long time? And there was a point where I didn't believe that. I got myself into a very dark place. I wasn't looking after myself properly. I wasn't having proper supervision or clinical supervision, all the rest of it. I thought everyone was a perpetrator. Everyone was a sex offender. Everybody was, you know, a dark soul, as it were. And I got myself into a very dark place, but it didn't last long, because I'm kind of I'm quite a natural optimist. So for me to be in that place was quite difficult. But I believe that people are inherently good, unless, you know, we know for sure that they're narcissistic or psychopathic or, you know, whatever. And we all carry elements and traits of personality difficulty. All of us do. It's when they become problematic to us or to other people that, you know, we've got a bit of a problem. And I think, you know, thinking about what you're saying there, I don't know, I suppose it depends on our natural standpoint, don't we? If we're naturally suspicious as people, it's harder for us to,
I mean,
you know, he's, I don't trust you till you prove me, and I'm like, I'll trust you till you prove I can't. You know, which has caused issues.
Well, you see, my natural standpoint is we all have the capacity for good and evil, and the reason why I say people should be taught more is to promote pursuing the good, because
yeah, I like that. Yeah. Or
promote developing those discrepancies that Fiona's mentioned quite often, because that's how we are sort of progressing positively in life. If you can create those discrepancies to say, okay, not in such a binary way to say black or white, or
Oh, it's always a spectrum. Yeah, everything's grey. There's never nothing really is black and white in nature.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose, you know, you can have two kids who one is, every time this child has been kind, it's not ended well for them. They've been bullied or they've had their pocket money taken or whatever. That child will go on being kind because it's part of their inherent personality construct. Whereas the other child, when they've been kind and had that experience, they'll become less kind because they see the world differently. Yeah. Does that make sense? It's so complex. I mean, you could analyze it for hours.
And chatting to you as well, because you've been in the industry for such a long time, you really understand and you have the quite a talent, I would say, for articulating your point. Really and truly, I came in knowing bare bones of your origin or your journey up to this point for us to have a conversation. And I just want to thank you for being just open and honest with us, because that's the whole point of having this podcast, is to create a space for ourselves and then whoever can join that as well, to have open conversations where we're able to, AJ keeps saying this in subsequent episodes, we need to find our most common denominator and then build from there. And really and truly, I feel like you've managed to, I don't know, like, he sung your praises and I was a bit skeptical. I'll be honest. I was like, nah, is she all that awesome? Is she as amazing as this guy's going on about? For like 2-3 days
straight. No, I am a total knob.
2-3 days straight. He was like, oh, the conversation was amazing. I'm a better man. So, I just kinda like, yeah.
Calm down, mate.
Pipe down, mate.
Baby steps, AJ, baby steps.
Hey, Okello here. This section is a space where we'll be sharing short stories, creative experiences, and art. Eskia Mahlele, 1919-2008. Eskia Mahlele is a South African writer and activist. He is best known for his memoir, Down Second Avenue, which tells of his childhood and early manhood during apartheid. He began his career teaching high school English and Afrikaans, but his career was shortened when he started protesting the Bantu Education Act. He left South Africa soon after and began teaching in universities abroad. In 1977, he came back to South Africa and taught at Witwatersrand University, where he made history as the first black professor. While at Wits, he taught African literature and spearheaded a department devoted to it.
With calmness and stillness, it comes to an end. We hope you found some gems and go away richer in soul and spirit. We're showing you the three paths of the sage. Your path is your own. Which path do you follow? Until next time.